Good afternoon. My name's Matt Kemp. I'm president of the Toledo chapter of the Federalist Society, and it's my privilege to kick off our final panel today by introducing the moderator, the Honorable Steve Yarbrough from Sylvania, Ohio. Judge Yarbrough has had a long career in public service for the people of the state of Ohio. Graduated from the University of Toledo, both as an undergrad and with his JD. Served as a councilman for the city of Toledo. He served as a judge on the Toledo Municipal Court, as a judge for the Lucas County Domestic Relations Court, a judge for the Lucas County Court of Common Pleas, chairman of the Lucas County Republican Party, a state senator serving representing the folks of Northwest Ohio here in Columbus, a visiting judge, visiting trial judge all over the state. I think he said he's sat in over 40 counties, which is, I think, some sort of record in case anyone is keeping track of that. And most recently, he was elected to the 6th District Court of Appeals, from which he just retired a month or two ago. And he's already resumed his visiting judge duties, hoping to chip away at the remaining 40-odd counties that he hasn't visited yet. He's also, I could just add, a good guy to have a beer with. He's very generous with his time and advice to young attorneys in Toledo and to law students. And so it's my privilege to welcome Judge Yarbrough.
Thank you, Matthew, and it's a pleasure to be here. You hear all that. This guy's got a short little span of attention, you know? He went to this court and that court. He's got a short span of attention. But I enjoyed my public service very much, and I certainly enjoyed the judiciary. But the biggest, largest amount of my time was spent in the trial court, although the last 6 years have been in the Sixth District Court of Appeals. I'm back now in the trial court as a retired judge sitting by assignment. You know the difference, right, between the responsibilities of justices of the Supreme Court and how they look at cases, and the difference between judges in the courts of appeals and how they look at cases, right? And then I suppose some of you are litigators, so you know what the trial judge does when he or she is on the bench, the jury's in the box, the witness is on the stand, objection, and of course the judge has to rule right away. So there's these distinctions. That distinction was best described to me by my mentor, who said, it's like the three judges went duck hunting. The Chief Justice, the Justice of the Supreme Court, is in the first blind, the appellate court judge is in the second blind, and the trial judge is in the third blind. As luck would have it, the ducks come in over the blind of the Justice of the Supreme Court. She looks up, looks and says, wonder what the public policy is on shooting ducks. Wonder what will happen in the rest of the state if this duck gets shot. By that time, of course, the duck has left that blind area and is over the blind of the appellate court judge. Appellate court judge looks up and says, standard of review. What's the standard of review on ducks? Wonder how this will work out. Is this a final appealable order? And of course, the duck flies on to the blind of the trial court judge. Trial court judge stands up and shoots it, says, hope that was a duck. We're very lucky to have the judges with us that we have, and I think the program has saved the best for the last. We're lucky to have these scholars as our colleagues, and lucky for them to give their time and spend it with us. And they've done a great deal of public service, and this is one more public service that they're doing. So let me introduce first the Honorable Judith French. Judy French became a justice of the Supreme Court of Ohio in January 2013 and was elected to her first full term on November 4th, 2014. The justice has traveled throughout Ohio, visiting all 88 counties. She has a history of public service and has a special interest in civic education. Justice French is committed to serving as a resource for the people of Ohio. For the past two decades, Justice French has dedicated her career to public service. In that time, she has served the state of Ohio as a lawyer for a state agency. She has served as an assistant attorney general, and she has served as counsel for the governor. And finally, she has served as a judge and now justice of the Ohio Supreme Court. Welcome, Justice French. We're also honored to have Judge Jeffrey Sutton with us today, who has served in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit since 2003. Before his appointment to the bench, Judge Sutton was a partner in the law firm of Jones, Day, Reeves, and Pogue, where he practiced appellate law and constitutional and commercial litigation. He served as State Solicitor of Ohio. In that capacity, he served and oversaw appellate litigation on behalf of the State of Ohio Attorney General and participated in complex litigation on behalf of the state at the trial level from 1995 through 1998. After earning his law degree at The Ohio State University in 1990, he clerked for United States Supreme Court Justice Lewis F. Powell, Jr. and Justice Scalia from 1991 to 1992, and further for Judge Thomas J. Meixel on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit of the Second Circuit from 1990 through 1991. These colleagues have agreed on the order of their presentation, and by luck of the draw, Judge Sutton's going to go first. We'll make short presentations and then turn it over for questions. Judge?
Thank you, Judge Yarborough, and thank you to the Federal Society, and I think in particular to Ben Flowers for organizing this. It's very impressive, and I'm really thrilled that Ohio, I was down at the Florida conference, I don't know if it was their third or fifth, and I think they had 500 people there, and but it started, I don't think, quite as big as this. So in about 3 years, we'll have about 500 people. So thank you, Ben. This is really terrific. So I don't mind the appellate judges being made fun of. In fact, I can make it worse. You know, that appellate judges are known for coming in after the battle is over and shooting all the wounded. And, you know, I think there's certainly something to it. But I don't want to let the trial judges get off scot-free. So I will tell this story, presumably apocryphal. The judge is going through the mail, and he's opening an envelope. He sees it's from plaintiff's counsel in a case, and he opens it, and there's $5,000 in it, cash. He's like, wow, that doesn't happen every day. He sees this later in the mail, another envelope. This time it's got $10,000, return address defense counsel. Wow, this is unusual, same case. Quickly brings the parties in and says, you know, we can't do this. This just isn't the right way to handle the courts. And so here's what I'm going to do to solve the problem. I got five from the plaintiffs. I got 10 from the defendants. I'm going to give five back to the defendants, and then I'm going to play it straight. Equal justice under law. So the way we're going to do this, this will be fun. I mean, you'll see Judy and I have slightly different views about this topic, which is going to be fun. I get to just talk about it and not practice it, and Judy practices it, which is perhaps why we have different perspectives on it. But what I'm going to do is give a little bit of an overview of the role of state constitutions, why there really even should be a second chance at winning on behalf of your client in the state courts, talk a little bit about why state courts might think about interpreting their state constitutions a little more aggressively, and then Judy will respond a little bit with a presentation, and then we'll open up for questions. We decided to sit down with the music. We thought we'd start dancing if we stood up. So I'm going to start with a hypothetical that has four fanciful facts. Fanciful fact number one is that in Monday's national championship, Ohio State is in the finals. Fanciful fact number two is Michigan is the team they're playing. Fanciful fact number three is Michigan is ahead with very little time left in the game by 1 point. And here comes a longer presentation of fanciful fact number four. The Ohio State star is driving the lane. I don't even know their names. It's such a weak team. I don't even know who that would be this year. But anyway, he's driving the lane. He shoots just as time runs out. It's a two-shot foul. And so time's run out, and here's the situation. It's not a bad position for Ohio State to be in. He's got two chances to tie the game, go to overtime. You can still win the game in overtime. And if he makes both shots, you know, we're national champions. How fanciful, strange would it be if the Ohio State player took just one of the two shots? Well, of course, that's an utterly implausible hypothetical, and I agree it's utterly implausible. But if you agree with me on that, we've got some explaining to do when we shift from American basketball to American law. Because oddly enough, in America, even though every corner of the country is governed by a state and federal constitution with one conspicuous exception, the District of Columbia. But everywhere else, there's a state and federal constitution that governs state and local laws and their validity. And yet in my experience, 14 years in the Federal Courts of Appeals, I've seen just one case where a state constitutional claim was brought with the federal constitutional claim. When I was state solicitor of Ohio, I did see more cases where state constitutional claims were brought in the state courts, but not that many. And I think if you doubt me, Justice French will have a chance to give her piece on it, but when they are brought, they're not really developed well, they're not really briefed well, they're really seen as arguments of last resort. And that seems strange. Why wouldn't you want to take two equal shots at invalidating a state or local law? And what exactly is going on here? Well, I could give a whole separate talk about why we have this problem, why it relates to the law schools not teaching it, it relates to state constitutional law not being on the bar exam, it relates to our deep respect, perhaps too much respect, for the U.S. Supreme Court. But for whatever reason, the state courts in general lockstep with the federal courts when it comes to interpretations of their constitutional guarantees, whether they're identically worded or similarly worded. And that's strange. It doesn't seem like that's an obvious consequence of a system of federalism where you have state and federal courts, and each state court has the final say over what their own constitution means. So let me give a couple explanations as to why state courts and state lawyers in making these arguments might think seriously and take seriously the idea that the state constitution ought to be construed to provide more coverage for individual rights than the federal constitution. Well, the first idea behind all of this is an historical one. The 13th constitution in this country, it turns out, was the United States Constitution. You might say, well, weren't there 13 colonies? Well, Rhode Island had a little trouble getting around to a constitution. It actually didn't have a constitution before 1789. So the 13th Constitution was the U.S. Constitution. All of the individual rights guarantees in the U.S. Constitution, whether we want to talk about Bill of Rights guarantees or some of the others in the original Constitution, come from the states. The only original idea in the U.S. Constitution is federalism. Everything else is plagiarized, if you will, from the existing 12 state constitutions. So first, as a matter of history, we ought to be taking seriously the state constitutions and the rights in those constitutions because they were there first. It was the federal constitution that came second and was modeled after these state guarantees. The second point should be a pretty obvious one, at least for the lawyers, not necessarily for the judges. But of course, from the lawyer's perspective, two shots are better than one. And most clients are extremely result-oriented. That's the most result-oriented group there is. They don't care why or how they win, whether it's the federal constitution, the federal court, the state constitution, or the state court. They just want that state or local law nullified. So surely it makes sense from the perspective of the client to be taking two shots rather than one. Why might you be able to win under the state shot when you can't win under the federal shot? Well, sometimes there are differences in language. If you know the Ohio Constitution, just look at the religion clauses. Free exercise and establishment type provisions are quite different from the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Quite often, there are differences in history that might lead to differences in interpretation. Surely, free exercise guarantees from states like Maryland, Utah, and Rhode Island are going to have a different history behind them than those in other states with different histories. There's also going to be differences in culture which might inform the interpretations by the state courts of those guarantees, even though they sometimes are word for word like the U.S. Constitution, which is no surprise since the U.S. Constitution modeled the first eight provisions of the Bill of Rights after the existing state guarantees. But surely a state with a culture, a rural state that cares a lot about hunting might treat differently an individual right to bear arms than an urban state. And there's no reason why state courts shouldn't honor and respect those differences. Obviously, the U.S. Supreme Court, I guess it's not that obvious because it seems like they sometimes do it, but the U.S. Supreme Court should not be premising decisions about individual rights guarantees on the culture of one state or even one region of the country. I mean, they have to be doing something for the entire country. A court like Ohio's is free to pay attention to its own history, language, and culture in doing whatever it wishes to do with that state constitution because it applies just to that state. You're not nationalizing it. It's not only true that state constitutions give you a second shot rather than just one, I think that it's a better shot. And the reason I think it's a better shot is that U.S. Supreme Court decisions, it sounds counterintuitive, but I would say all U.S. Supreme Court justices are Burkean conservatives in one sense. They're nervous about nationalizing an issue for the whole country, 320 million people, 51 jurisdictions, God knows how many localities at once. Even Justice Brennan would have had that dynamic going through his head. I'm not saying he always listened to it, but he would have been thinking, this is a very big deal for our court, 5 to 9 of us, to nationalize this point for the entire country. That's just not true for a state court and a state constitution, where you may be talking about 13 million people, one state jurisdiction, obviously a much smaller number of localities. It also so happens that at the state level, it's a lot easier to correct or shift direction with a state court decision. As we all know, the U.S. Constitution is virtually impossible to amend, requiring 3/4 approval of the states, whereas most state constitutions can be, all of them can be more easily amended. Ohio's can be amended with a 51% vote. So there's reason for correctiveness reasons that you can be more adventurous as the state court judge. If it doesn't work out, recorrect, either because you amend the Constitution or perhaps because they're elected judges, you replace the judges. You don't have that option, certainly not as easily, at the U.S. Supreme Court. Sometimes there's nothing wrong with a state court simply disagreeing analytically with what the U.S. Supreme Court has said. It may be the phrase unreasonable searches and seizures. The U.S. Supreme Court may have adopted a plausible, reasonable interpretation, but surely it's not the only interpretation when it comes to a phrase like unreasonable searches and seizures. And there's nothing wrong with state courts looking at those decisions and saying we just disagree, and as a matter of state constitutional law, we're going to construe our guarantee differently. In fact, it's quite surprising to me with the reality that about 90% of state court judges in the country are elected. It's really quite surprising to me that more of them don't more often say we disagree entirely with this or that decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. God knows the people in their states disagree with many of those decisions. It's incredibly strange to me that these elected officials are not saying, when they have the opportunity, I have no idea what the U.S. Supreme Court was thinking. That does not speak for the people of Ohio. That's not what the Ohio Constitution means, and here's what we're doing differently. It's just quite odd to me. The last reason perhaps is the best, and that's that many guarantees in both the state and U.S. constitutions contain what you might call, as law professors like to say, indeterminate language. Unreasonable search and seizures, due process of law, equal protection. Is due process just procedural or is it substantive as well? As to these guarantees, it's incredibly strange that this country takes the view that 5 people in this country are going to have the final say over what these indeterminate words mean. It's just shocking to me that more state courts don't look at that language and say, I can understand why they did what they did, but you know, we're gonna take the live and learn experiences at the federal level with that particular guarantee and try something different. I mean, think of equal protection. I mean, Larry Tribe says there's now 7 tiers of review in equal protection. Does not anyone think that's a failed project? If it is a failed project, why is not a state court saying we're gonna try something a little different with our own sovereign authority to interpret this Constitution differently? So there's so many areas of law where the U.S. Supreme Court, the federal courts, God knows I'm one of these judges, are doing the best we can. But I think we all know that's all we're doing, the best we can. And there's nothing about these decisions that says that's the only way to think about it. Quite often, the wisest way to think about it, the very federalist way to think about it, is we should have 51 imperfect solutions, not one take it or leave it, all or nothing and all, imperfect solution. It's just far better to have 51 of them, and that's why we have 51 highest courts in the land. Now, the hardest part of my opening presentation is to acknowledge that this approach is not good just for conservatives. This approach has the problem of being entirely neutral. Forgive me. It is helpful to liberals when it comes to outcomes, and it's helpful to conservatives when it comes to outcomes. When it comes to liberals, you wouldn't have had Obergefell and the same-sex marriage constitutional right revolution without the state courts in Goodrich in Massachusetts. That was a revolution that started in the states, and it's a classic example of the state courts having the right to do exactly what those state courts did. Whether you agree with it or not, they had that right. School funding, as all of us know in Ohio, is another example. Criminal procedure rights, still another example. On the conservative side, after the Kelo decision, the Ohio Supreme Court didn't follow it. See Norwood. After the Smith free exercise decision, the court didn't follow it. See Humphrey. Across the country, you have lots of areas where state courts are choosing not to follow what the US Supreme Court has done. And I'm shocked that there's not more of this out there. We've had many people talking about administrative law. Where is the state court out there that's saying Chevron's a bad idea, our deference is a bad idea, delegation is not a good idea? State courts have the right to say, and in fact, there actually has been a study on this. Doug Ginsburg did a study recently that shows a lot of the state courts are much more reluctant to go down the federal delegation road. But there's nothing that prevents the state courts from doing this. We all know how the most recent affirmative action case ended at the US Supreme Court. There was a new lawsuit filed in Texas state courts just recently relying on the Texas Constitution. So the outcome of Fisher can be overruled in Texas under the Texas Constitution if that's what the Texas courts choose to do. The Michigan affirmative action case, that's just how it ended, although not with a Michigan State Supreme Court decision, which could have happened. It happened with an amendment to the Michigan Constitution. But there's nothing that prohibits these debates from being resolved differently. Now, last of all, I said, unfortunately, this is a neutral proposition. The last way in which it's neutral is it's quite neutral when it comes to all methodologies of constitutional interpretation. It advances all of them. It's, of course, good for originalists. Why wouldn't originalists want to look at state court decisions about the original meaning of these state guarantees, since all of them were the models of the federal guarantees? What better evidence is there of the original meaning of these guarantees? See, by the way, Justice Scalia's decision in Heller for just that point. For pragmatists, their whole mode of operation is what works, cost-benefit analyses. What better way of seeing what works than looking how the states have experimented differently with different constitutional guarantees and different interpretations? For living constitutionalists, it's indispensable. I mean, the living constitutionalists can't, or at least shouldn't, say norms have changed because I've looked in the mirror and I think they've changed. They have to look outside themselves to find something that proves norms in society have changed. Well, what better way of looking for norm-shifting events than developments in state courts and state legislatures? So that's my, I hope, sufficiently provocative opening, and I can't wait to hear what Judy has to say.
Me either. I almost don't know where to begin. I guess I should begin with Jeff's point that the state Supreme Court justices should disagree with the federal judges, and I'm going to disagree with him. So he's getting his way. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It is a little bit of a mystery as to why I'm the justice who's here, since I've been in the dissent on this issue on every single case since I've been on the court the last 4 years.
I think you figured it out. This is remedial.
I see two of my new colleagues here. Maybe they will see that it's remedial too. Well, first, let me say thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure for me to be here and to talk about this topic that I do feel really strongly about. I have to agree with Jeff and with many others who say that the state Supreme Courts do have independent authority to look to our state, to look to our constitutions and interpret them differently. I wholeheartedly agree. I think the problem for me has been, particularly in the most recent cases by the Ohio Supreme Court, is the way in which we're going about our analysis. And I would even say that there really has been almost no analysis on the question of, are our provisions different? How are they different? if they are different, is that meaningful? So if we are going to look independently at our own state constitution, whether it's due process or equal protection or free exercise, where do we begin with that? Well, for me, you look at the constitutional conventions, you look at the at really the foundations for those provisions, and that's part of what's really missing, I think, from the analysis from the majorities in our court. But that's not to say that in every case, I think the state Supreme Court has gotten it wrong. Jeff mentioned the Humphrey v. Lane case that involves the free exercise clause and the comparison to the Ohio Constitution. I think in that case, Justice Pfeiffer gave probably what I see as the most thoughtful analysis in the majorities in these kinds of decisions to say, you know, our free exercise clause isn't just a free exercise clause. It's a rights of conscience clause. There is a difference there. And let's talk about that. Let's look at the founding. Let's look at what the Ohio framers intended. Just if anybody is keeping score and saying that I would never be able to find an analysis good enough for when we want to take an independent route, I think Humphrey v. Lane kind of gives a good example of one time when I think the analysis itself, don't know if I would come out the same way, I'm not going to take a position on that, but that there's at least an analysis there. There are several of these decisions that have come out recently, and by recently I mean since I've been on the court, so for 4 years. State v. Bode looked at the due process rights of juveniles. State v. Brown 2 for the insiders, the rights against unreasonable searches and seizures where a police officer is outside her jurisdiction. State v. Alum, the due process rights of a juvenile to a hearing prior to a bind over to adult court. State v. Mole, favorite in this area, the right to equal protection for a peace officer accused of having sex with a minor. In all of those instances, the majority, I think, has decided to take an independent view of the Ohio Constitution, which they're allowed to do, as Jeff would say, but have done so without really any depth of analysis. So that, for me, is really where my difference lies. But I guess I would echo what Jeff said, that there is an argument to be made. Any lawyers out there who are beginning a case in the trial court and you are not raising the Ohio Constitution when you are raising the federal Constitution are really missing the boat. I am amazed at the number of cases still that we get, and we've had them even yet this year, where the case has come up after these more recent decisions and they're still not raising the Ohio Constitution. That might not stop a majority on our court of looking at it anyway, but I think that you really have to be raising the Ohio Constitution. It is absolutely a real issue. So I do agree with a lot of what Jeff has said. I just wish he wouldn't talk about it quite so much. I mean, I kind of blame him for the recent resurgence, although I do recognize this is something that's been in discussion, you know, for the past 20 or 25 years, and isn't just all of his making, but a lot of it is. I'm kind of convinced. So with that, I will say we agree on some. It is just really difficult to swallow in the practicality of it.
Thank you. That State versus Brown case was a Sixth District Court of Appeals case. Oh. I wasn't on the panel. questions, comments? Go ahead.
Well, while you're bringing that around, I'll do one little response. Just one thing to keep in mind about this is the opportunities for dual claims for two shots is a lot newer than you might appreciate. So I was emphasizing federalism, so you might say to yourself, well, why have people not been doing this these 220 plus years? And the answer, of course, is that the Bill of Rights guarantees didn't get incorporated, most of them, until really that was getting settled towards the mid-60s. And the last thing an individual rights claimant was thinking about in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was, oh, I need to go to state court to get relief. I mean, that was ludicrous because you had a very inviting U.S. Supreme Court that was innovating one right after the other. What's started to create this opportunity is the fact that this is not the Warren Court, and it's a court that still innovates and invents rights, but not as much as used to happen. So the idea of lawyers thinking about bringing two claims, developing them independently, state courts figuring out how to sequence their decision making on this is actually new. So I think that's one thing going on. The other thing I would point out, which is really consistent with Judy's criticism, which I quite buy, is that the first proponent of this was Justice Brennan in 1977, who wrote this quite famous Harvard Law Review article, which said, you know, I've started losing cases at the US Supreme Court. I'm writing some tremendous dissents, and you, it was like a letter to state court judges, you, state court judges, have the authority to adopt my dissents, by the way, under federal law, as the majority position under your state constitution. Many liberal state courts and state court judges said, yeah, sounds good to me. Most conservatives thought, well, wait a second, that just really undermined the whole idea. It looked, they looked at the messenger and thought, this is just a result-driven enterprise. And they looked at the message, read my dissents about the meaning of the US Constitution, and using them under the state constitution. So the messenger and the message, I think, dramatically undermined the cause in terms of broadening its reach. And what really needs to happen, and I really think this is, it's partly the law schools, but it's ultimately the lawyers. The state courts really are referees. They're not players. And if you're not briefing and developing the history as to why these guarantees are different, I mean, gosh, many of them are linguistically different. It's just not that hard. You don't even have to go to the 1851 Constitution. Just read the darn language. But many of them are linguistically different. It's very strange to think that they would somehow mean exactly what the US Supreme Court has said different language means. But you've got to make the argument, because I will say, I'm not going to pick on particular decisions, but some of the ones I've read do read kind of result-driven, the Brennan model. We will because we can, not we will because that's the right answer, and that's what the history, the language, precedent shows. So I don't blame the state courts for that. I blame the lawyers, frankly. I don't think the lawyers are doing a good enough job in terms of developing these arguments, briefing them separately from the federal arguments, indeed urging the state court to review the state arguments first. You know, you win in the state court on a state argument, case over. No one can reverse you. If you win on the federal ground, it's reviewable by the US Supreme Court. Why is that good if you just won? So I really think I think we're in agreement on this point. And I think you would agree there's some areas you'd be pretty excited to see state lawyers briefing them independently.
Let's say they are raised and they are briefed. That would be great. Right. But I do want to make one counter. I do want to make one substantive point, too, and that is this idea that it's only really been for the last 50 to 75 years where it was thought that those rights were applicable to the states through the Due Process Clause. I think that feeds into my substantive arguments that if you have, for example, in the 1851 Constitution, you know, the Constitutional Convention, where they replace an earlier provision on search and seizure, and they take almost word for word from the Bill of Rights and the search and seizure provision, it was before the federal Bill of Rights was applicable to the states. So you would think that that might actually feed into an argument. There was an intent by the Ohio framers to borrow from the US Constitution. Not to say that we couldn't still interpret it differently, but I think the fact that this is a recent use of this kind of a principle can feed into the substance as well. And you know, we talked a little earlier, you mentioned earlier how this could, it doesn't work always to the conservative way of thinking. To me, the most fundamental conservative principle for me as a judge is to follow precedent and to stick to stare decisis. For me, that's the most conservative and fundamental principle. And so if you have decades worth of decisions saying our provisions are the same, we should harmonize our provisions where we can if the language is the same, then for me, the conservative view is to say we better have a good reason for departing from that precedent. So for me, those conservative principles can very much come into play, at least at that fundamental level.
There's a question here.
I'm gonna So just in defense of lawyers, I guess this one's mostly for Judge Sutton. You expressed some amazement with not seeing more decisions reading the state constitution differently from the federal. To what extent is that the product of the Supreme Court reading some rights so broadly that it's inconceivable that any state court could read their right even more broadly?
Yeah, so that's a great point. There are two answers. Of course, that wouldn't apply, say, to property, contracts, takings. There's whole administrative law, there are whole swaths of law where that point doesn't apply. But the second thing, and if I haven't agitated Judy already, this is surely going to agitate her. And I have to acknowledge it's also tremendously unfair. But your question conveys a perspective which is shared by most people, which is fundamentally wrong. And that's that this whole enterprise is worthless if, as Ben says, you get a case as a state court judge and there's federal and state claim, and you look at the federal and you're like, oh my God, I mean, they've done so much here. There's no room left for innovation. And the implication is that means you shouldn't say a word about the state guarantee. Wrong, in my view. And Tom Lee on the Utah Supreme Court has several opinions doing just what I'm talking about. The state courts have an obligation to tell the people of the state, the country, what the meaning of their guarantee is. They have the right to say, to give an example, the exclusionary rule is a very complicated debate in unreasonable search and seizure law. And if you look at the history, it's quite complicated as to whether that guarantee was meant to come with an exclusionary rule. We know after MAP there is a national exclusionary rule under the Fourth Amendment. Nothing prohibits a state court from reading its guarantee as Justice Lee did in the Utah Supreme Court and said, I don't need to get into these debates about how the Utah exclusionary rule applies because there is not such a rule. And so he did this really wonderful historical analysis and said, that's just off the table. So the point I'm making is, it's always relevant, it's always deeply helpful for state court judges to be telling us what the original meaning is. And it's very helpful to originalists at the federal level, because now the originalists can say, wow, have we noticed the number of state courts saying they've decided substantive due process, to use an example, is not such a great idea? How is that relevant? That's relevant to the originalists. That's starting to become relevant to the living constitutionalists. Norms are changing. Norms can go up and norms can go down. It might even be relevant to the pragmatists. Now, the reason, if I were in Judy's position, I would hit me, is that's a lot of extra work for no practical reason. Well, because it doesn't have a practical effect. But I consider it useful. But now get away.
Justice French?
Useful could also, you could also say advisory. And so if, for example, you have a criminal defendant who has lost at the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals has found that the seizure violated the United States Constitution, and so that criminal defendant is gonna come up to us, even if there's still some sort of a live state constitutional question, I don't see that getting four votes to come in, because it would, you know, it's advisory at that point. If you already know that the evidence has to be suppressed under the US Constitution, then our discussion under the Ohio Constitution would be merely theoretical and, I think, advisory. And again, a conservative principle is you don't decide issues that you don't have to decide. So that, I think that's the practical problem of getting a question like that into a state Supreme Court where there's discretion.
I don't think it's advisory, and I also think it's definitely some work. There's no doubt about it, and requires briefing by the lawyers, but it's indispensable to know what the baseline is for Ohioans. Is the baseline that the higher guarantee is federal or state? That's what they need to know, or are they identical? And so if we never talk about the state one, we never know. If there's no state claim in the case, obviously it's advisory, but if someone brought a state and federal claim, it's not advisory to explain how they both work and establish a precedent that says, from here on in Ohio, there's no point bringing the state claim because we don't even have an exclusionary rule. So if you want relief under an exclusionary rule, you gotta bring the federal claim. That's a helpful development. But I get it that it's a lot of work. And the other thing that I must say that I'm sensitive to, not that sensitive to. I've been writing all these articles. But makes me feel guilty. How's that? It makes me feel guilty. It's hard being a judge on an appellate court. You have all these different perspectives, whether it's three or seven. You know, you're constantly trying to get common ground. And one of the things I'm suggesting introduces a new point on which to disagree. And I have to say, I can really understand why a state court would say, oh, that's the last thing we need.
There was one question at the table behind you.
Thank you very much, both of you, for excellent presentations and good points of view on what I call new federalism. Because
yes,
I follow Brennan.
Good for you.
Yeah. I want to let you know.
But you got to go for all rights, not some rights.
That's
all
right.
Rights.
That's right. I want to let you know, Judge Sutton, I teach at a college of law, and for the past 25 years, I've required my students in criminal procedure, particularly with respect to the Fourth Amendment, to brief strictly on state grounds any decision, they can pick one, that they dislike. And one of the most interesting aspects of this assignment is, following what Justice French noted, was that in Robinette, you have to have persuasive grounds to dissuade the Ohio court from finding in harmony with the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of the Fourth Amendment. And one of the most, I think, compelling persuasive grounds is that state judges don't like to be overruled. They already have a fix on what the state culture is, and they've made a determination of what is reasonable. And in Robinette itself, the very case in which the court said, we're not going to go for this new federalism thing. We're going to be in harmony with the U.S. Supreme Court. And the question there was, what relevance is there to an absence of a warning requirement in determining whether or not there was a consent to a search? And what the Ohio Supreme Court had said, well, you have to have the warnings requirement. And the Supreme Court says, no. We've already decided this many years ago in Bustamante's. No warnings requirement. Consent is just voluntary. We don't care whether there's warnings or not. So when the case was remanded back to the Ohio Supreme Court, this is before your time, Judge French, the court said, okay, we agree with the slapdown by the U.S. Supreme Court, but we will consider the absence of a warning as a factor in determining whether or not there was consent. So at the very same time the court is saying, we're not going to do this new federalism, they did it. And so I just want to introduce one other factor as to why there might be a compelling reason, and that is not only a culture, but if you can find somewhere on the Supreme Court of the state a prior ruling by that justice that is overruled by the Supreme Court, they're more likely to find their original thinking more persuasive than what the Supreme Court came up with at a later time.
Okay.
Well, I think, I might say there's two different ways to think about it. On the one hand, from the lawyer's perspective, surely you want them to rule on the state ground,
because
that's case over, no more appeals, you win. I think at the state court, I think it varies from state court to state court, because I think you're right. Some judges care about not being reviewed and reverse, but in states with elected judges, I don't think that's a culture in Ohio, but I do think there's cultures in other states where there's a little bit of a tendency to want to have it turn on federal grounds, because you can say the U.S. Supreme Court made us do it.
Right.
And that's not a bad answer when you're out on the campaign trail and someone's complaining about your, quote, radical decision. If your decision blurs the lines between state and federal or locksteps federal and state guarantees, you're now inoculated from criticism. The person's really criticizing the U.S. Supreme Court. So I don't think that's happening in Ohio, but I worry that happens in some other states.
Well, and I will say that, you know, for many of us, we relish the opportunity to dig into a great federal constitutional issue. But again, you have to look at the practicality of, is it a live issue? Would it be advisory? So I don't get the sense that anybody, I know, at least on our court, nobody's shying away from these issues. My gosh, these are some of the most spirited decisions, opinions that we have over the last several years. It is kind of nice to be on the Supreme Court where you're not going to get reversed. But once you step into those federal, the federal analysis, obviously you're game for a reversal. But there's not a shy person on our court.
You have two new justices on your court. Does that change things?
I certainly hope so. I would love to be in the majority
the
on these issues.
A gentleman had a question. The blue shirt.
I guess in response to Judge Sutton's remarks, it seems to me that maybe one explanation for why you're not seeing a lot of focus on state constitutions is that in the last five decades, the United States Constitution has proven remarkably pliable in the U.S. Supreme Court, and there's been awfully fast evolution and incorporation of shall we say, shifting norms or shifting views. And in a willingness to sort of do a, you know, stick a finger in the wind and try and figure out which way societal winds are blowing and incorporate that into the Constitution. And so it seems to me there might not be a lot of breathing room left then on top of that, I guess picking up on Ben's point, on top of that for state constitutional guarantees. And then I think you might layer on top of that some notion that individual liberty guarantees tend to be at some level anti-majoritarian in the sense that you're using some constitutional promise to overturn a majoritarian law, and you've got at the state court level predominantly or often at least elected judges or justices, and so maybe there isn't quite so much willingness to step out on a limb. I think you just used that in your last remarks, noted that there may be at least some less willingness to step out on a limb in a sort of anti-majoritarian principle. And so it seems to me the confluence of those two, that you have already the United States Supreme Court going awfully far, maybe awfully quickly, in anti-majoritarian directions in terms of identifying and giving force to new constitutional guarantees, coupled with that other, what we can call political reality. I wonder if that might not be some explanation for why there isn't more development of these state constitutional guarantees.
It's a great, great question. I mean, so one short answer and then a longer point. The short answer is it's just a total head scratcher to me that, you know, some very conservative state courts in the country where they have elected justices, someone's not getting up when they and asking them the question when they're doing Lincoln dinners. By the way, under the Texas Constitution, do we have substantive due process? I see it's just a procedural guarantee. It's due process. Do you think it has a substantive guarantee? I would think that would be an incredibly winning issue as an elected state court judge in at least half the state courts in the country. So it's just a real head scratcher to me why electability doesn't lead to innovation and disagreement with the U.S. Supreme Court, as opposed to it always making them more shy. But the broader point, and this is probably the main reason a federal judge has been obsessing about state constitutions for the last 15 years, is I feel, when it goes to your first point, the U.S. Supreme Court and federal constitutional rights, that this is something the Federal Society people know as well as anybody. We have two options, in my view, and this group is probably divided right down the middle in which path to take. Option A, when it comes to innovation of new rights under the U.S. Constitution, U.S. Supreme Court, is if you can't beat them, join them. They get their rights, we'll get ours, and both sides just keep innovating more rights, which continues the path you suggested. Option B is a form of detente where both sides say, you know, we gotta let more of these issues be resolved locally. If option B is that, for what it's worth, I prefer option B, because on option A, I have no idea how you pick people for that job. I mean, it just gets too powerful. And option B is naive, I get it. But if you can have option B, one way to think about it is Americans do like their rights. And vigorous state constitutionalism allows to have it both ways. A U.S. Supreme Court that is showing a little more restraint, and people still have the opportunity at the state level to get state rights. But at least they're more easily correctable, and they just apply in one jurisdiction. But yeah, it's a good question.
Well, just to clarify, I have never been asked about substantive due process at a Lincoln dinner. Never.
Well,
now,
just
this,
wait, Judy.
In
the
this
question
group?
In back there, that young man in the white shirt has raised his hand three times. We got to get to him. Further back.
So I have a question for Judge Sutton, because I'm not as concerned about Ohio judges handling both the federal constitution and the Ohio constitution, but I'm a little bit curious about the mechanics for, let's say, federal judges in a double shot case. At the appellate level, then I guess you would be dealing with four constitutions that you'd have to kind of be familiar with. And at the district court level, they don't even have the ability to certify to state court the constitutional question. So how would that work mechanically? And do you feel district court judges and appellate court judges in the federal level are competent to answer those questions?
Yeah, no, well, after hearing me, I can understand why you'd worry about the competence of federal judges. So just to make sure I'm getting the question right, I think I've got it, which is, how does this two-shot opportunity work in the federal courts, and is that really a good idea? So, as I said early on, I can only remember one case where two shots were taken, and so you might think, oh, that's just a function of federal courts, right? They are federal issues. And that's just not true. We hear lots and lots of state law claims because we have diversity jurisdiction, which is purely state law, and we have pendant jurisdiction on federal questions. So just kind of federal courts, we can get them both. So now competence to resolve these things. Well, you know, when I got that one case that had the issue, I thought my ship had come in and I was just going to go to town. It was going to be like a book-length opinion about state constitutionalism. It turns out the Michigan Supreme Court locksteps. So it was a religion clause case, and their establishment clause interpretations are identical to the federal. So I was stuck.
Did you at least say in the opinion? But you could make it different. You could go different.
You know, I was actually pretty aggressive in the rest of the opinion as is. So it's City of Detroit versus American Atheists, if you want to read it. I did enough damage as is in that case, but. The district courts and the courts of appeals can certify, so that's actually not a bad idea. We are allowed to certify. Now they have to accept it. We can't impose that on them. But I'm just as federal judges interpret state statutes and state common law all the time. I'm not troubled by their interpreting state constitutions. It's not going to be the final say. The state Supreme Court in another decision could clearly disagree, no doubt about that. But it just doesn't happen it's just really strange. It hasn't happened. And I think it goes to the fact that the course isn't taught, it's not on bar exams and so forth.
I think that'd be a great certified question on the state constitutional. We just don't get many certified questions, period. So to get one on a constitutional question would be really, excuse me, out of the ordinary. And on several of them recently, we've sent them back. We decertified. And
why?
We said,
because
we said this is not going to really resolve this case. There are other issues that are going to resolve the case first and completely. So once again, we're back to the practicality of, do you really need the answer on the state constitution if the federal constitution is going to resolve this case? But that would be a great question for another day.
I just to kind of tag along with that question, well, what about the doctrine of federal constitutional avoidance? Or do you think that some of these, maybe there aren't enough certified questions because lawyers aren't asserting abstention doctrines under principles of comity and federalism? Or maybe federal judges are ruling on them too much? You know, maybe Judge Sutton's view of, you know, ruling on state court decisions where maybe you've got a zoning issue or a tax issue or something, or somebody just throws in a substantive due process, maybe that should be in federal courts, and it's not because of the litigators or, you know, however it shakes out.
Well, so this is going to go from bad to worse, Judy. But this is not my idea. This is what the Oregon Supreme Court does. And just to give you, you know, 50 states, right? You can have a lot of different approaches here. But due to this Professor Hans Linde, who was professor first in the Oregon Supreme Court for about 15 years, highly influential, and they don't really have Fed Con law in Oregon, it turns out. They basically, the cases are all state con law, and only if you're going to lose do you have this backstop federal claim. And it turns out the Oregon Supreme Court has actually been largely more aggressive than the U.S. Supreme Court, so that's how it's worked out. But here's their methodological approach, which I think is coherent, but very few other states are doing it, and only Oregon does it rigorously. They say this, no one has to bring two claims, but if you bring two claims, the state courts have to resolve the state claim first. Why? Because almost all federal constitutional claims run through the due process clause. They're either a due process claim itself, an equal protection claim, or they're incorporated rights claims, the Bill of Rights. That means they're incorporated through the Liberty Clause, the due process. And so Linde's point, which I think makes a lot of sense, is constitutional avoidance reasons. Why would you ever address a due process, Bill of Rights, equal protection federal claim until you've decided what state law provides, particularly on the process side? If state law corrects your problem, lets you out of jail, gives you the money you're owed, gives you whatever you think you're entitled to, the federal constitutional claim has disappeared. So they rigorously flip the order from what most state courts do. Instead of thinking of the federal one as the prioritized, they prioritize the state one. State lawyers eventually got on board and prioritized it in their briefing. And you know, it's really analytically coherent that you would never get to the federal claim until you've decided what the state provides. Does this, speaking of advisory opinions, does the state law, state constitution, state regulation, state court decisions grant this person relief? If so, the advisory opinion is the federal constitutional ruling.
Justice French.
We would just need so much more development. I think at the trial court level in Ohio first, for these issues to be raised, for them to be fully developed, fully analyzed, fully briefed. I think we're a generation away maybe from having them so fully developed and thought out. We are absolutely not seeing that kind of a development. Maybe the solicitors group would like to disagree with me on that, but we're definitely not seeing that level of development.
Maybe one more question, then we'll close.
So this is one of my favorite topics. I had about 10 questions in mind, but 9 involve pending cases, so I had to scratch them.
If they're in the state courts, I can answer them. This is why I love this topic. I'm never recused. I can say whatever I want.
But this question goes back to
talk about Ferguson.
Analytical structure in Mole, because that's closed and dead and gone, so I think I can ask this, is the problem I have with that one, unlike some of the whether other clauses where the wording might be different or not, is there the court said our equal protection guarantee in Ohio is not in lockstep with the federal government, we can do something different. The problem I have with that textually is that Ohio doesn't have an equal protection clause at all. And it is only through artificial lockstep theory that we warped our due course of law clause into an equal protection guarantee. So it seems to me it's having it both ways to say, aha, it's our duty to be lockstep with the feds to create an equal protection clause that doesn't exist, and then say, but as to the content of what's in it, now we're going to go in our own direction. And so I'm wondering if there's no equal protection clause mole-like that I'm involved in that I know of now, but is there a problem that you see with making our guarantee different when we don't even have one?
I dissented. I mean,
thank you.
Throw in that it was really, it was really an as-applied challenge, and the holding was facial unconstitutionality. It's not my favorite. Are Fisher and DeWine here? I mean, I think they are. You know.
All right, we're going to bring it wrap it up.
Yeah.
Judge Sutton, any closings? Remarks?
Well, I mean, I'd love to write that dissent. I could write that. I could write the dissent and the majority. The dissent would be.
The dissent's already out there.
The dissent would be. The dissent would be to do the historical analysis, a la Justice Lee, and say, well, this is just made up. It's not here, and we have a federal guarantee, so use it. But when it comes, don't invoke the state one on this point, because I'm assuming you're right. I don't know the answer to this, but assuming you're right, that's the way it works. That's fine.
Justice French.
Well, and that's really been the heart of my dissenting opinions. It's just we have to all acknowledge I am not bound by the federal analysis. Ohio is not bound by the U.S. Constitution. We get to independently look at our own Constitution, but there has to be an analysis to that. You know, if we're going to follow stare decisis, if we're going to at least explain our precedent and keep our precedent stable, we have to have a reason for departing from that. And I think Mole is just one of those decisions, and what unfortunately has been is getting to be a long line of decisions where the majority went the other way by saying we can do something different and we're going to. And for me, that's just not enough.
Okay, we got a little housekeeping matter to take care of, but listen to me carefully. Thank you very much for your attendance. Judge Sutton, Justice French, ladies and gentlemen, you make me proud of my profession. Please keep it up.
Thank you to our panelists and to Judge Yarbrough. My name is Lisa Yazell. I'm the Vice President for the Federalist Society's Lawyers Chapters, and wanted to thank all of you for attending. This is our inaugural first conference here in Ohio, and we really hope that we have an expectation to make this an annual event. So look forward to finding out more information about a conference in 2018. I have a very important housekeeping item, and that is the CLE number. So I will wanted to read this to everyone. We have 3.75 hours of Ohio CLE credit approved. That number is 000-352-348. I'll say that one more time. 000-352-348. I'd also just, on behalf of my colleagues in the national office, I would like to thank our Ohio chapter leaders for all of their hard work in putting this conference together, in particular, Ben Flowers in Columbus, Matt Byrne in Cincinnati, Matt Kemp in Toledo, and Dave Tryon in Cleveland. And I'd also like to thank our leaders from the Ohio State Student Chapter. We're very grateful for all of your assistance in helping us to organize the conference, and also for volunteering here today with registration. So with that, I'd like to adjourn the conference. We have a closing reception featuring the two new justices on the Ohio Supreme Court, Justice Pat DeWine and Justice Pat Fisher. So the reception will be right outside the door, so please join me, and thank you again for your attendance today.